Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Who Inspire. I'm Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Megan Buchanan. And Megan Buchanan, it'll be just a couple of days before Megan is will be on Mount Everest. You know, it seems so daunting, not, of course, not training for it, but just the thought of it kind of leaves me speechless. So you have like a week left, and first of all, I gotta say, you know, Godspeed to you, and you know, this is something that I've never encountered before. You know, never spoken to anybody who's preparing for such a tremendous feat. So in the last week before, as you get ready, how do you feel mentally?
Oh, first of all, thank you for well wishes. Yeah, and it is kind of a crazy thing to say. Yeah, I'm leaving for Nepal in 6 days, and I'm going to go climb Mount Everest. And, you know, it's definitely, I usually don't bring it up to people. My friends usually bring up, oh, did my friend Megan, here's what she's doing, because then there's always an explanation. You know, they're like, you're just going to base camp, you're actually climbing it. I'm like, yeah, I'm climbing it. And it is just this, like, so many people look at me like, first of all, why? And second of all, how on earth did you get into this? And it is like, I am mentally, I'm ready. And like, even more than that, I'm physically ready. And I always look for, the gratitude in things. And as we've talked about, supposed to go last year, and it got, you know, the Everest season got canceled 2 weeks before I was to leave because of COVID. Mm-hmm. And again, I was, you know, pretty bummed out for a good 24 hours, but then, you know, COVID just came in so fast. Like, I saw how grateful I was, first of all, to be stuck in my own country with my own health care when this was all coming through. But I have gotten to another physical level of training and being prepared than I was last year. I thought I was ready last year. I'm so happy I had another year to really work more on some of my technical skills. And I like, in a way, I feel like really earned my place on that mountain. And yeah, so I'm super excited. I also have a little bit of anxiety just because there's so much still to do before I go, just getting everything. You even like all your medications you need to get in as compact as possible, get that organized, your med kit, your, you know, weighing everything. I'm allowed 2 50-pound bags plus my backpack. So you just have to start stripping out the extra. So there's just a lot of little small things that you need to start doing now and get everything ready to go. And I fly out next Friday, March 26th, and into Kathmandu.
So when you said, what's the beginning of it? What's that called again? The beginning of the climb.
Oh, the beginning of the climb. Well, we'll do a little while ago. We were talking about the Khumbu Icefall, but that's after base camp. So the very beginning, we actually fly into into base camp.
Is that a big tourist attraction?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I will say, if you've ever worn it, I completely recommend doing base camp, hiking to base camp. It's usually like a 2 week out and back. It is beautiful. It is challenging. And you really get to see another culture. And the Nepalese people are so kind, and it really is some of the most beautiful scenery. I mean, you just sit in awe, but you fly into this little town village called Lukla, which is rated the world's most dangerous airport because it's like the size of a football field that kind of goes up into a mountain, but then it drops off thousands of feet. But you're on that little plane or helicopter into that airport, tiny, and then you start hiking. you start hiking right from the get-go, and we'll take about 9 days to get to base camp. We'll acclimatize the whole way up, but base camp 17,500 feet. So you start your journey acclimatizing, and then we'll stay several days at base camp to start getting prepared, you know, just be at that altitude for a while, and then we'll start our first rotation. And a rotation is up and through the base camps that follow up, like, or camps, camp 1, 2, 3, and, you know, acclimatizing, and then come all the way back down to base camp and stay a few days, or go up to camp 2 and stay a few days there and come all the way back down to base camp. And we go through the Kumbu Icefall, which is right above base camp, and that is where the iconic pictures are of the walking over the ladders, over the crevasses, going up and over ice blocks the size of buses. And it is that is a very dangerous portion, that the Kumbu Icefall moves 3 to 4 feet a day. And so the Nepalese have like these ice doctors who maintain that through the season. But the company I'm with is going to take out a one rotation through the Kumbu, and we're going to go up and over a little mountain called Loboche to take out some of the danger of having to go through the Kumbu an additional time. And that helps us acclimatize as well.
Good.
And then, we condition our bodies, getting it ready for that summit push and going over 29,000 feet over, you know, 5 to 6 weeks. And then we go for summit when the weather presents itself, does not present itself. And there's that 2-week window in May that we can summit. So should be on the mountain 6 to 8 weeks.
Wow. So
I know.
6 to 8 weeks. How strenuous is, the 6 to 8 weeks, you're not like, you know, exhausting yourself every day. What's the time frame during the 6 to 8 weeks that you're physically to the point where, you know, this is it, this is your summit, where you say, this, you know, I can't, this is it, I'm lost for words, Megan, sorry.
Yeah, no, I think I know what you're saying, like, when, at what point at what point is your body pushed so hard that you're done and you can't do
right.
anymore? And since I don't know when that point is, because I haven't reached that yet. I think that's why I'm doing this one. Because mentally, I'll tell you what, I mean, like, man, this is the thing, you know, we've talked for several weeks now about all of these different, you know, the tools of grit, gratitude, growth, resilience, integrity, tenacity, and all of those things mentally, that is what has led me to where I am now and attempting and plan on summiting Everest, is because so much of it that people don't get is how much is mental. Like, that our bodies are so amazing and strong and can push through so much. It's usually our minds that stop us, not our bodies. And when you finally get to the point, when you practice like these tools and get to the point where you really understand that, it is hard, but it's easier to say, even when my mind's like, oh man, like I'm done. My body, then there's that little voice that says, take another step, take another step, take another step. And and that's where you go. We talked about this too, like what kind of training I'm doing now. And I'm not, I pulled back on the really heavy packs. So the 2 weeks before, so last week and now this week, I'm doing cardio, Pilates, keeping up some strength training. I'm not doing anything hardcore. I don't want to risk injury. I'm letting my body kind of rest a little bit. But I was mountain biking, and I was going up this huge climb. I go through these conversations in my head of, I'm like, man, you know what? I didn't sleep as well as I wanted to last night. I am kind of tired. I'm in great shape. I don't have to finish this ride. And I go through all these things in my head too, like everyone else. And then my other little voice goes, yeah, but hey, guess what? We're leaving for a week for Everest. If you give up right now, then what the hell are you going to do on the mountain? Like, let's just finish this ride. You can do this. Stop complaining.
Right.
And I say this to myself. And I'm like, all right. And I just keep going.
Right.
I think, again, it's that learned behavior. And what we talked about, too, like holding yourself accountable to no one else but yourself. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know that if I want this goal of Everest, they always say, like, don't be in the best shape of your life. Be in Everest shape of your life. And
wow.
that is something I kept saying to myself during this time, too. Like, I've always been in great shape, but I took it, like, to another level this time. I wanted to train right and do it right because I'm worth it to me. I'm worth it to give the best shot I've got at summiting this mountain. And you're responsible for, you're in a team. I want to be in my best shape ever and best prepared I can be for, you know, the livelihood of the other people on my team as well.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about food. When you're climbing that mountain, I mean, you can't stop at a Wendy's and pick up a hamburger. What average day look like for food consumption?
So especially the hike into base camp, we will be staying at, you know, tea houses and villages along the way. That's part of that Himalayan trek to base camp, where if you do just a trek to base camp, you'll get to experience this. And they have cooks, and I've gone, this will be my fourth time to Nepal, and I went once when I was 29 in Annapurna, and it was a lot more rustic, a lot of potatoes, cabbage, some mm-hmm. meat. I learned quickly to not eat the meat there because I got food poisoning, but things have gotten so much better over the years. But then as the years go on, they are fantastic, and they'll try to be like, hey, we made you guys pizza. We know you're Westerners. And so it's, you know, it's not pizza, but it's pretty close. But the food's gotten so much better, and they just try to do kind of stuff that they'll do a lot of pasta. I'm gluten-free. I can't eat it, so there's a lot of rice and, like, curries and just some good stuff that sticks to your bones. When we get to base camp and the higher camps, and Camp 2, my mountaineering company, Climbing the Seven Summits, and most mountaineering companies have a chef and a cook. And so they're making, usually stuff that is palatable. A lot of people will lose their appetite at higher altitudes. I have not had that problem yet. But we'll see how it goes. But they try to do stuff that definitely has a high calorie content. So, again, a lot of rice, curries, something warm. And there's a lot of, in the higher camps, you'll do a lot of kind of those dehydrated foods in packages. And camping food like that has come a long way. And we ate a lot of those at the top of Denali, and they're really good. So there's a new company now that I really like. I think it's called Food to Go. I'll have to look that up. But they've got some really fantastic stuff. You're in higher altitudes also. You are honestly trying to just eat as much as you can because you cannot possibly take in enough calories to equal what you're putting out. So a lot of people have to start force feeding themselves. I think that is one thing that limits people on a climb. And my Denali guide, Mike Haugen, had told me, he's like, Megan, you like what gets you to summit or not is if you can eat. And he's like, you have got to eat, and that will get you to summit. And he was so right. I mean, I have never had to eat so much as I did on Denali because of the work that was involved in Everest. I expect to be the same.
So even though you've done a peak, what from the time you started until you reached summit, how's your weight? Do you take weight off even though you're eating a lot? Do you still have the problem? Okay. Tell us a little bit about.
Yeah, because again, it's I need to look at the. I used to always. I think it's above 17,000. I mean, about 17,000 feet. Your body, like, kind of starts eating itself. Like it again, it's very hard to intake the calories to put on weight after a certain altitude. And so, yeah, you end up like, that's why I always say it's kind of like a vacation. I'm like, man, I get to sleep in my warm tent, my little sleeping bag, and eat whatever I want, read while you're waiting for weather or resting. It's awesome. But, yeah, your body is working so hard just at altitude. You are burning through calories. And so you do want to eat very high caloric meals and intake. Like you'll do these dehydrated foods. It's like, you know, 1,000 calories, 1,200 calories in the packet, 800 to 1,200 calories, which normally, you know, especially as a woman who we're always counting calories, you'd be like, oh my God, what? But right. You have to, because your body will get too weak and it can't maintain. So yeah, you always drop a good amount of weight on a mountain.
Well,
and there are theories too. Go ahead.
The coaches there, the people that, you know, go along with you, do they monitor your weight as you progress?
You know what they'll do usually, because they're used to people losing weight, but what they monitor is your performance. And if your performance is going down, if they notice that you are weak and you have been strong, you know, they're going to notice if you're finishing your meals, if you're eating, and they will say, you need to eat more. And that is part of you know, they're guiding us. They're trying to help us. Because, again, a lot of people really do lose appetite, and it becomes hard for them to eat. I think when you get to the level of Denali, Everest, any 8,000-meter peak, I think that you are a person that has figured out if you have problems with appetite or not, and you have figured it out, and you know you have to eat. So at that point, the guides probably, maybe with less experienced people, but otherwise a person like myself, if I notice at Camp 3 I just don't have an appetite and I can't get something down, I will tell my guide and be like, all right, here's my problem. I've never experienced this before. What should I try to eat if I can't eat this? And you know, then they'll help me. But,
you know,
yeah.
I think that's every American's dream for somebody to tell them, you need to eat more. We're a society that's overweight. And to hear those words, it's really.
It is. Yeah. But if you think about it too, like, again, as a female growing up, always being told that I have to be thinner, I have to be thinner, I have to be thinner, the mind game this does, or what I had to train my mind to take in those calories, because you want to repel that. No, I can't eat that. I can't eat that many calories. So it is, over the years, I've had to get used to it and be like, well, if I want to reach my goal, I have to eat these calories. And your body, it is, like, I think for any athlete, it is really this amazing thing to be able to witness your body becomes a machine. And even the training I've been doing really hard for the last 4 months, I am to a point right now where I could eat. I'm eating a lot more because I am working out so hard. And if I want to get the workouts in and get the strength gains that I'm looking for, I've got to fuel my machine. And so, anyone who wants to do this too, it's great. I got a nutritionist like years and years and years ago and just learned so much. And I've done a lot of reading on how to fuel your body for mountaineering, for athletics, and, just eating the right things. And it's been really, really cool to see how your body processes everything. Our bodies are really amazing.
Now, you know, there's many sports out there that people participate in. There's running, there's swimming, you know, all kinds of things. Stair climbing like I do. Would you say that mountain climbing is the most, what's the word I'm looking for? The most challenging of all of the sports there are.
Oh, I could not say that in any way. You know, I think it's such a different combination of things. There's so many sports too that you train and train and train for like a 30-second race. And
right.
That to me seems so much harder. You know, mountaineering is, you know, it is the slow and steady. It is, you know, it takes a lot of time. It's a sport for patience, for sure, mm-hmm. Which I think mentally can be because it's long duration. There are very dangerous portions there can be, but it also is about, it's about patience and long endurance and muscle endurance. So it's just a different kind of hard. And I think it is definitely a passion sport. Like I said this before, you've got to love the struggle to love mountaineering. You've got to love that challenge and the struggle of what you put your body through and what you go through mentally to be able to enjoy this and do this. The love of the struggle.
The guides that you have, do they climb year after year?
Yeah, a lot of them do. I know, like my guide on Denali, who, you know, and then you have co-guides too. We have a lead guide. They, like Mike had climbed, I think he summited Denali like 15 times. He's done it year after year, and he's really well-respected, one of the best. My guide for Everest, who Mike put me in contact with, Casey Grom, he right now is recognized as you know, just the guy on Everest that has got it dialed in. He has summited the last 5 years in a row, minus last year because no one went last year. And I got to meet with him in Ouray and start getting some advice on how to get certain gear and different things ready. And he really does. He has got, you can read all day and night about it, but he was giving like real-time application of how to get my ascender set up with my carabiner. And he's like, this is what works. And it comes down to also, I think if you go with a guided company, you know, I do a lot of research. I want to go with someone that has, you know, the same kind of methodology I do. And Casey's awesome. He knows when to joke around, but he's very serious when he needs to be serious. And he expects you to listen and he expects you to do what he says because he's right. And I, you know, I live in this world where, you know, it's grit and I'm out there and I'm putting myself out there and I speak up for things I do in work, I do on the mat. But when it comes to this sort of thing, I know when to shut up and listen and do what the expert is telling me to do. And a lot of times that is what will help you summit or not as well, is, you know,
right,
listening and doing what you need to do. And he already told me, he's like, I don't sugarcoat, I don't handhold, because if you need sugarcoating, you shouldn't be on this mountain. And I agree with him. I agree with him.
You know, we've been talking now for a few months on the podcast radio show, and you know, you know a little bit about me. I know a little bit about you.
Yeah.
But one of the things that has come to being as our conversations progress is I've contacted a friend of mine who does coloring books, and there's a possibility that, you know, at some point in the future, she's going to be doing a coloring book on Megan and what it's like to be a mountaineer. And I think that's so exciting. Because I think there's so many different ways that you could, you know, just get your story out. And your story does need to be out there because what you do is important. It's inspiring. And it'll help people. You know, that's what I think.
That I mean, that really means a lot to me. And I get teary because I think it's so important for women and little girls to see what they could be doing and the possibilities. I remember as a little girl, my dad, you know, I think I'm talking, he was a brilliant, brilliant engineer, you know, world scholar at MIT. And I remember we were talking one day. I was actually homesick and I saw the shuttle explode in sixth grade. And it just, like, I remember just bawling and crying. And when my dad got back from work, he asked me, like, what's wrong? And I told him, I'm like, I cannot believe all those astronauts died. And how can I stop that from ever happening again? And my dad really explained what aerospace engineering was to me, and he worked in aerospace. And I'm like, that's what I want to be. I want to be an aerospace engineer, but I don't want to have to look like a boy. And my dad's like, what? And the only female engineers I had seen were, you know, they were not feminine. And he's like, he pretty much said, oh, he called me pumpkin or cutie pie. He's like, cutie pie. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. He took me out of school the next day, and he took me to work, and he introduced me to every female engineer at his company. There weren't a lot, but there were a few. And then he's like, will you please talk to my daughter about being a female engineer and how important it is? And wow. I got that. Yeah. He, again, I always talk about my parents were amazing, and I want to help share that. Little girls need to see women doing things they're interested in. And even though they might be typically, you know, boys do that, forget that. They need to see women doing it, and they need to be encouraged. And women need to see women doing things. That's, and I have right. so many girlfriends of mine who pull me inside and just say, thank you for sharing your story. This is like, I always wanted to be an engineer, but you know, I just wasn't encouraged, or I always wanted to do this. I'm really good at it. And then I'm like, it's, what are you doing right now? Like wherever you are in your life, if there is something that you've always wanted to do that wasn't traditionally for women, start doing it today, you know, and we need to encourage each other. Yeah.
Megan, we're out of time. So give your contact information.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much. So it is, www.ggrit, so ggrit.com, and you can also find me on Instagram at getgrit with the two G's, and follow my adventures. I'm going to leave soon, and you and I, Cynthia, will talk again before I leave. We'll also talk in Kathmandu. I'll give you the lay down of the land.
Okay. Megan, all the best, and I'm sure everybody listening to this wish you the same. So we'll talk soon. You've been listening to Megan Buchanan. This is Women Who Inspire. I'm Cynthia Pooler. If you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.